And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. Monday edition of It's Your Turn. Monday, June 12th. And, you know, for the first time, it really feels like summer, doesn't it? Yeah. If we're lucky, we get this kind of weather over Memorial Day weekend. And it's not all that unusual to have at least a little bit of this weather in May. We did not have it this year. May was lousy. In fact, I was listening. This is kind of a coincidence because I wasn't doing this on purpose. I was listening to the tape of an earlier show, one of the It's Your Turn shows from back on, I don't know, like May 4th, May 3rd or 4th, something like that. And there was a forecast of snow. There was a possibility of snow in the forecast for that day. I mean, the entire month of May wasn't like that, but it wasn't very good. No, it wasn't very good. It was passable on Memorial Day, but it wasn't really warm. All of a sudden, man, oh, man, it feels like summer. It looks like summer today. Have you been outside at all, even, you know, just on the back porch? We've got that hazy sunshine. And you only get that kind of sunshine around here for a short time when you got a real summer day, you know. It's not fog, it's haze. And we had it from early this morning. It's nice. Nice. A little hot for you? For some folks, I suppose, a little warm. Yesterday, might be surprised to know, the high was only 85. Felt warmer. Humidity levels were starting to climb. But it was quite breezy if you were out and about yesterday. The breeze kept the air moving. 85, the high. We are already, today, just past 12:30, we're up to 86 here in the city of Butler. And they're predicting temperatures near 90 today. So hang on. Get the popsicles and the Kool-Aid ready. Thank goodness we don't have to worry about making the ice hard tomorrow night or Wednesday night at PPG Paints Arena. When would Game 7 have been? Wednesday, right? If they had to play it. Of course, they don't because the Stanley Cup playoffs have come to an end. I've talked with more and more people. At first, I thought it was just me. I love the Penguins. I like hockey. There's nothing I like better than sitting with a warm cup of hot chocolate and listening to Mike Lang do a Penguin game on the radio. But it's a long playoff season, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's too long. 2 months, for goodness sakes. 2 months since the Penguins finished the regular season and began the playoffs. Boy, that's a long time. It's a grind, obviously, for the players, but it's a grind for the fans, you know? How many times can you catch yourself emotionally involved in a playoff game? Every other day for 2 months is pretty tough. But the Penguins pulled it off, and that's great. And it was an exciting game last night. Who would have believed that they would go down to just 90 seconds left in the game before anybody scored? 90 seconds left in the game, and it was still nothing. And then the Penguins, Patrick Hornqvist, actually, it wasn't a freak goal. I've seen Sidney Crosby do this a number of times where he's back behind the net, and he actually bounces it off the back of the goalie. But that's what Hornqvist did, bounced it off the back shoulder of the goalie. Rini, and that was it. You know? The other goal for the Penguins came on an empty netter after Nashville pulled their goaltender, trying to tie it up, of course, in the last minute with an extra attacker. Didn't work. So the Penguins win the cup. And I just heard an update from the mayor of the city of Pittsburgh. They are going to have a parade, but they don't know when yet. They're still ironing out the details. They have announced, the officials at Pittsburgh International Airport have announced that when the Penguins get back home today and they're flying in from Nashville today, they stayed in Nashville overnight, they will not be going through the terminal. So there will be no, there's no reason to go to the airport because you will not see the Penguins. After they land sometime this afternoon, they'll taxi to a private place that's not open to the public and get them off the plane there, and they won't be going through the terminal at all. So, and that's probably good news because that clogs things up, you know. Have you ever done that? Gone to the airport? No, I haven't either. No. In fact, very few times have I ever gone out to celebrate any sort of a victory. You know, you poured out into the streets. That some people like to do. I guess it was fairly calm in Pittsburgh last night. I don't know. Maybe the people are too wrung out emotionally, you know, to do anything. Plus, it's late. It's late, for goodness sakes. They don't start the games. Supposedly, it's 8:10, and then, you know, it's 8:15. They still haven't dropped the puck. They're messing around. And I know. I suppose they're going for the West Coast people. Tough bananas. Live in the Eastern time zone. It does make it kind of late. And for football, it's even later. And I can't tell you, other than a Steeler game, which I have on occasion stayed up late to watch. I don't even watch the late football games anymore. It's you know, for people who have to go to work, how can you do it? You know? Too late. Coming up on our program today, and we will be talking with our first guest here in just a few moments. And I was able to snag Alvin Felsenberg at the last minute, to be honest with you. Do you remember William F. Buckley? You have to be of a certain age. You don't have to be, you know, a senior citizen. If you're a baby boomer, you probably remember William F. Buckley. I don't know, our producer, Pat Parker, not a senior citizen. Do you remember Bill Buckley? Do you remember him on Channel 13? Probably, that's where you saw him. He had a program called Firing Line. Yeah. He was a conservative, almost a philosopher. I mean, I think he did run for mayor once of New York, but by and large, he was just a columnist, a writer, a thinker, and very much a conservative. But if you're of a certain age, you remember him. If you're not old enough, you know, you don't have any idea who we're talking about. If your idea of conservative commentary is what you see today on TV, on Fox, or if your idea of liberal commentary is what you see today on MSNBC, and those are the two networks that are, you know, most slanted toward their philosophies, and that's fine. Everybody knows that, so you know, you consider the source when you're watching either MSNBC or Fox. But they yell and scream, they have these panels on, and they argue. William F. Buckley Jr., Bill Buckley, never did any of that. He was very calm. He debated. He was a conservative. He debated some of the biggest liberals of his day. Did it live on TV, by the way. I don't think I've ever gone up against him. But it was always in a dignified manner. You know, I mean, he could disagree, be diametrically opposed to people, politically, philosophically, whatever. But they would come on his show and they would have a very civil discussion. It's something that we long for. Many of us long for today. A civil, calm, rational discussion of issues. And it wasn't boring. If you're old enough to remember Firing Line, and it ran for years and years on Channel 13, PBS, Channel 13 here in our area. It wasn't boring at all. Buckley always played with a pencil. He always, and he had these eye movements, and it was funny. He was interesting to watch. He had a very wry humor, but a cutting wit, you know. Not loud, not screaming, but he could make you look bad pretty easily. It was fun to watch. I enjoyed watching him. I didn't always agree with him. Sometimes I didn't agree with him at all, but I enjoyed his program. Well, at any rate, our first guest today, and he'll be joining us here shortly, Alvin Felsenberg is his name. He has written a biography of William F. Buckley, Jr., called A Man and His Presidents, and it's quite a fascinating look at this man's life. I knew a little bit about William F. Buckley. I didn't know a whole lot, but pretty good stuff. So we'll talk with Mr. Felsenberg, by the way. He was the principal spokesman for the 9/11 Commission, which investigated the terrorist attacks, which were now, you realize, almost 16 years ago. Wow. Oh, yeah. 9/11-01. Almost 16 years ago. He was the principal spokesman for the 9/11 Commission. He was the director of communications for the Joint Economic Committee of the United States Congress. He served in two presidential administrations. He teaches at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, that's Penn, in Philadelphia. And he holds a PhD in politics from Princeton. Smart guy himself, writing about a very smart guy, William F. Buckley, Jr., who died some years ago now, must be almost a decade ago. We'll talk to Alvin Felsenberg in just a couple of minutes. He's our lead-off guest today. Later on the program, Bill May, very popular historian and storyteller from our area. He's probably the guy who knows more about local history than anybody else I know. He's going to be doing a program later this week at Alameda Park. He's done many of these. His program coming up is on the old movie theaters of Butler. Fascinating, huh? Still later on the program today, we'll say hi to one of our interns here at WISR this summer, Julie Zarnick. And we'll also be chatting with one of the most popular writers of inspirational fiction in the country these days. Her name is Karen Kingsbury. Maybe some of you are familiar with her. She's written a whole string of books about a family, a fictional family, the Baxter family. She's got a new one out. It's called Love Story. We'll be chatting with her a little bit later, too. So we have a full schedule here today on the program. And just a little teaser later this week, James Martin will be with us. James Martin, S.J. If you used to watch Stephen Colbert, the Colbert Show on Comedy Central, he would have Father James Martin on occasionally, and they would debate. He's a great thinker and writer. He'll be with us later in the week. Okay, got to take a break here, and then back with Alvin Felsenberg. Nice to have you with us on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Each month, Radio PA gives you a chance to send a question or comment to Governor Tom Wolf during our Ask the Governor program. Your input can make a difference, just like Thomas in Center County, who was concerned about the state prison population counting toward the governor's proposed $25 per capita fee for state police coverage.
Prison populations included in these township formulas, is there a way to offset that, or is that just the way it's going
to be? I think Thomas makes a really good point. That's not right. So I will make sure that at least in the proposal that I make, I will modify that we don't count the prison population in that. So I think Thomas makes a very good point. Thank you for that good question.
You can be a part of the next Ask the Governor program by going to pamatters.com and clicking the Ask the Governor link at the top of the page. You can also email the program directly at askthegov@pamatters.com. That's askthegov, G-O-V, at pamatters.com. Ask the Governor is an exclusive presentation of Radio Pennsylvania and pamatters.com.
Listeners, we're going to be chatting on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. And if you're just joining us, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visiting with us by telephone is Alvin Felsenberg. He's the author of a wonderful new book entitled A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. First of all, Mr. Felsenberg, welcome. Great to be able to talk with you for a few minutes here today, sir.
Wonderful to talk to you, Dave.
William F. Buckley, Jr., known by many. There's an upcoming generation, though. Gosh, I hate to think they would not have experienced this man, would they?
No, that's why I wrote it. I thought we could bring him back to them.
Yes.
I don't think they've lived in an era where we had such a civil person debating with the likes of every intellectual of his time in the most genial manner possible.
Yes, millennials and those younger, I mean, I suppose they could find some of his stuff on YouTube if they wanted to see him in action. But if they want to find out about his life, they should pick up a copy of your book because it's fascinating. You cover a sizable period in William F. Buckley's life. From when to when, Mr. Felsenberg?
Well, he was born in 1925. And he left us in 2008, and I covered the whole story from a brash young teenager who thought he had all the answers to all the world's problems and was supporting Charles Lindbergh's America First movement against FDR's attempts to shore up Britain during the Blitz, all the way to his election and influence on Ronald Reagan, where he significantly changed his views, as did Reagan, a former liberal Democrat, became a conservative Republican under Buckley's tutelage through the George Bush era, really through the end.
Let's talk about his multimedia mastery. Many of our listeners will perhaps remember him from his work on PBS. We'll talk about that in a moment, but talk first, if you will, sir, about the National Review, because listeners may not be quite as familiar with that.
Well, first of all, he was an extraordinary communicator. He operated on multiple levels. When he left Yale University, he wrote a book called God and Man at Yale, which was an attack on what we now call political correctness that had been taking over at the university. We can come back to that a bit. He was active in the anti-communist movement in the 50s and had the idea that he could set up a magazine that might bring all conservatives under one roof, where they could find out what other conservatives were thinking and writing and where conservative identifiers among the public might be reached. Hard to imagine that was the only magazine of its kind at the time. Respectful conservative point of view, did not have any touch of extremism or some of the things that the left always says about the right, whether they're extreme or not. But it had civil writing, it had great humor. But that was not all he did. I said operated on many levels. 5 years later, 1962, 5 years after starting the magazine, he was offered a syndicated column, called it On the Right, at a time where you just didn't do that. There were virtually no other conservative columnists of the time. So because of that, and because of his telegenic presence, he was invited on that new medium then, television, to debate the leading liberals of his time. So he's debating Arthur Schlesinger, the historian, John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, Norman Mailer, the novelist, Garbage Dolls, the playwright. Now, in our professional lives, we've all known people who punched above their weight, as we like to say. But that's a lot. He was doing the work of 20 people for the longest period. He was the only conservative recognizable on television, the only conservative columnist. That was not enough. He did 70 public appearances at universities a year. He wrote for sports magazines. He wrote for aviation magazines, wine magazines, cigar magazines, Esquire, even sat for a Playboy interview. So wherever you were, he found you. which really gets us to PBS. He was not only interested in talking to conservatives, he wanted to make converts. And he wasn't going to make converts among those who go to church every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to find you on your boat and in your bar and in your dance. And even if you were not interested in politics, he'd write for Esquire about social things and Truman Capote's mess ball, 1966. Well, but in the middle of that, he would squirrel the politics in. You'd get it. Now, this was an era before social media. This is an era before email. This was old technology, type away on his old Royal typewriter.
Listeners, a little bit about our guest, and if you've joined us a couple of minutes late on this segment, if it's your turn, that's fine. We're talking with Alvin Felsenberg. He is the author of A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. So was Buckley always a conservative? Did he change in his approach to conservatism over the years? Talk about that, Mr. Felsenberg.
He changed in a lot of ways. Isolationism was the order of the day when he was growing up, which explains Lindbergh, mm-hmm. and explains the early period.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a great brander. He was a great promoter of his father's politics, which were isolationism. So at the age of 16, he was a master sailor. His parents bought him his first sailboat. So what did he call it? Sweet Isolation. Knowing every time he won a ribbon, his father's views would be in the story. And World War II, of course, changed that. He realized in a hostile world with some dictators determined to impose their will on the planet, maybe that view had to yield. And after the war, he became a rather strong anti-communist and a firm interventionist. So he changed his views. He also changed conservatism. In the early days, he wrote some editorials that are hard to read for the 21st century orientation. He not only opposed the Brown versus Board of Ed decision, which mandated separate and equal, but were unconstitutional on the face of it, but he also said that whites should rule because they were the superior race. That's the part that's hard to take. You could argue the first part of unconstitutional grounds.
Mm-hmm.
But as the 60s progressed, and as the resistance to civil rights became extremely vitriolic and violent, and the rise of what he called the welfare populace, people like George Wallace, who only opposed federal intervention when African-Americans were the beneficiaries of it, but were perfectly happy to take every Great Society program to build up the budget of Alabama, and were very incendiary in their rhetoric, and we'd call it race baiting as a method of campaigning. He changed his mind considerably on that. A turning point was the 1963 Birmingham bombing of a black church where four little girls in their Sunday best were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He really began to rethink his views that if the South was going to be, in those days, that impenetrable, that resistant, and that violent, then there was perhaps no alternative to federal intervention. He came around on that. He broke with conservatives on several things. He was one of the early ones to say that juvenile sentencing was unfair, that blacks had a higher number of incarcerations compared to whites who committed the same crime. He believed in free markets and competition. When he ran for mayor, he was an early promoter of what listeners would know as Uber today.
Yes.
He couldn't understand why a person with a clean driving record and a good reputation couldn't rent spaces out in his car to passengers willing to pay for a ride. Well, it's not a fair jump from that to Uber. He's one of the first to talk about school choice, although in those days he called it vouchers for parents, middle-class parents who were struggling to send their children to parochial school.
Let me ask you about presidents, because our time begins to run short here. Your schedule
sure.
is very tight.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan was his favorite president. He broke with George Bush, however, over the Iraq War.
Yep.
What do you think Bill Buckley would think of Trump if Buckley were still alive?
We have a couple of ideas. If Trump carries through and cleans out the swamp with special interests, people who are here to lobby for their own selfish gains, he would cheer it on. But he was very concerned about separation of power, whoever the president was. He felt Congress should be an assertive co-partner to the president, that the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader were not presidential aides, always commenting on a presidential program, but had an agenda of their own that they would compromise with the president to enact. Separation of powers, constitutional checks, were very important to Buckley. He was very weary of what he called a cult of personality, which he had seen rise as a young man in Europe and other places. So I think it'd be mixed. And he certainly would support anything that lowered marginal tax rates, which he saw as a way of spurring economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the president's talked about 4% as a goal. That's pretty much where we were in the Reagan years. We actually did a little better with that, but we clearly have to do better than where we are. We're at 1.5%, 2%. That's very anemic for a country this size.
I'm sure there are young people today, whether they're millennials or even younger, who, when we talk about conservatives and liberals discussing things, their only model is the screaming and yelling that we see well, let's take two, Fox News and MSNBC. They would have no idea of the intellectual and rational and calm the debates. But I can remember when I was coming of age discovering Firing Line on PBS and being fascinated by this gentleman. Totally different from what we see today on TV.
Well, he wanted to make converts on the other side. That was so great about the show, because you were turning in, and others with a liberal perspective were turning in, and they had to watch the same show. Sometimes their own opinions were challenged, sometimes reaffirmed. But let me end with, our public people don't have a sense of humor anymore. They don't have a tremendous set of wit. Imagine a man running for mayor of New York, and what would you do if you win was the question, demand a recount was the answer. He admired great wits of the 19th century. He read the speeches of some great senators. He very much admired Adlai Stevenson and John Kennedy, not for their politics, but because of their humor. He gave conservatism a happy face. George Will said that Bill Buckley had the smile that could light up an auditorium. I can attest to the validity of that. I've seen it many, many times.
I saw it on TV, and it's true.
When he made the cover of Time, the headline wasn't William F. Buckley Jr., conservative writer. The headline was William F. Buckley Jr., : conservatism can be fun. The fun has left politics these days, and that's what I think our millennials have been, don't even know they've been robbed of it, by the slugfest nature of our politics, everything being reduced to a soundbite, and people tuning in just to get reaffirmed. Reaffirmation of what they thought before they turned it on. That's not education. That's not civic responsibility.
Let me close with...
You would be saddened by that.
Let me close, listeners, with two testimonials. One, and you might well expect, George F. Will, who really loved Mr. Felsenberg's book. They both loved language, very much so. But here's a testimonial that might surprise you from Chris Matthews, host of Hardball on MSNBC, who talked about in his testimony, in high school, I searched drugstores for each new issue of National Review. It was that important. He loved your book as well. He must have been pleased to get that testimonial, sir.
I was honored because, again, Chris wanted to see what Buckley was saying about his own views. I mean, he was a young Democrat at the time. He would go on to work for Speaker O'Neill after Jimmy Carter. And if Bill Buckley was challenging them, they better find an answer. But even as a young teen, he was very interested in ideas. Well, if you can get that kind of respect from the other side, which Buckley clearly did, that's a sign of his lasting achievement. I wish some people today leave that kind of legacy. We'll see. We have to get back to that somehow.
The title of the book is A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr., by our guest for the past few minutes here on It's Your Turn, Alvin Felsenberg. Thank you, sir. Nice to talk with you today. Thanks so much.
It was a great pleasure, sir. Thank you.
If you're tired of being fed to death by the big banks, now is a great time to join the Butler Armco Employees Credit Union. With more free services like checking, online banking, mobile banking, and check deposits by phone, along with the best rates around on autos, home equity loans, and mortgages, you'll quickly see why over 26,000 members have chosen BAECU for their banking needs. It's never been easier to join, so stop in or join online at BAECU.com. You and your wallet will be happy you did. BAECU is federally insured by NCUA and is an equal opportunity lender.
We are gearing up for Father's Day and giving you a chance to win a foursome for Dad at Bird's Foot Golf Course. During the week of June 12th, tune in to WISR 680 AM during the 10 AM hour for your chance to qualify. Listen for our special Father's Day sound and be the correct caller at 724-283-2525 to win two Pennsylvania wine passes and be entered for a chance to win our grand prize, a foursome at Bird's Foot Golf Course. Fun for Dad. Father's Day giveaway right here on WISR 680 AM.
Welcome back, folks. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program on a Monday. Still getting over the fact that it's June 12th. My goodness. Close to halfway through June. But that does mean that some of the summer programs are going to be kicking into full gear, and that includes the Discovery Program, free programs each week, sponsored in part by the Butler County Parks and Recreation Department at Alameda Park. And for many years, local historian and storyteller Bill May has given some wonderful programs there, and it sounds like he's got another good one lined up to kick off the program this summer later this week. And he's here in the studio with us right now. Bill May, good to see you. Nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
A little bit of a preview of your program. First of all, it's this Thursday, is that right?
This Thursday night at 6:30 p.m. in the Carousel Shelter of Alameda Park, which is at the bottom of the hill.
Mm-hmm. You have done research and presented programs over the years on, well, Alameda Park itself. Some of the most notorious figures of Butler County history down through the years. And I know you've been working on this particular research project for some time, Butler's old movie theaters.
Yeah, I've been working on this talk since January and have spent probably several hundred hours researching this. The information just isn't opening a history book and copying it down. I've combed through archives, through movie magazines dating back to the early 20th century, through architectural magazines to find what I call gold mines of history, is you don't think something's going to exist. For instance, locally I could find no interior photos of the Majestic Theater, which the building still sits on the corner of Cunningham and South McCain Streets. So I was able to locate two interior photos of that from an architectural magazine in Ohio from 1904. I kind of feels like panning for gold, where I search all day looking for that nugget, and then when I finally find it, it's a eureka moment.
We're going to be just doing a little bit of a preview here today, folks, as we chat with Bill May. Obviously, you can get all of the details that he has to offer by attending his program this Thursday night, which is free, by the way.
It is free.
Mm-hmm. What time does it start? It
starts at 6:30.
So it's a good family time. What, hour and a half, something like that?
About an hour. And it is undercover in case it rains. It's in the large carousel shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So it is undercover if it does come down a rain.
Yeah, don't worry about that. And sometimes it does rain this time of year, especially at that hour of the day in the evening. Well, you have pictures and stuff to show.
I have dozens of photos, not just the ones I just talked about, but I have 13 very sharp photos of the interior of the Butler Theater, which sat where it's a parking lot now on Jefferson Street, right around the corner from Main. And that was Butler's true movie palace, was the Butler. And unfortunately, it was torn down in 1965. And when it opened in 1930, it was billed constantly as Butler's $500,000 movie theater, which would be about $5 million, $7 million today. And it was spectacularly beautiful inside with sculptures and statues. It was just a gorgeous place. And it was designed by probably the foremost theater architect in America, a guy by the name of John Eberson, who designed what were called atmospheric theaters. And he really did wonderful work on the Butler. And to see those again after all these years, what that theater looked like on its opening in 1930 is really quite spectacular.
I'm wondering, we're talking with Bill May, folks, about his upcoming program this Thursday. When I hear that that theater cost $500,000 and it was in the 1930s, my first thought is, wow, who had that kind of money to build a movie theater? Was that privately owned here in Butler? Do you know? Was it owned by, you know, like the predecessor of Warner Brothers or something like that?
The Butler, up to that point, a lot of our theaters were initially created by local Butler people.
Oh.
The Butler, however, was really the first one that was built by a theater chain. And it was built by the Harris Theater chain that was started by John P. Harris. And kind of a cool thing with him is he started, people have probably heard, there's a TV station called it, Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
And he opened the first theater in downtown Pittsburgh on Smithfield Street, devoted solely to the showing of motion pictures. And he named it the Nickelodeon. And that's where that term comes from, because he charged a nickel to go into his theater. So the Harris chain of theaters, I forget at the time the Butler's opened how many he owned, but it was a local chain of movie theaters, and that's who built the Butler Theater.
The interior then, and I think I was in that theater. You say it was torn down in 65?
Yes.
I think I was in there to see a film or two. I can't remember for sure. I can remember going into the Pen as a kid. But anyway, it's neither here nor there. So the interior of that would have looked a little bit like Heinz Hall. Or what did the Benedum used to be? The Stanley Theater before it was converted into the Benedum.
Because
they had all that
ornamentation. Rococo,
yeah.
The Butler Theater is kind of a transition for Eberson, where he designed what were called atmospheric theaters. Atmospheric theaters were theaters that made you think you were in a different setting. For instance, there's one, I show a few pictures of what he designed, where the ceiling would be blue with lights to resemble stars. The sides may resemble an Italian village to transport you. The Butler Theater is kind of a transition between that and Art Deco theaters. So they describe it when it's built as being of modernistic design. But it takes a lot of its elements. In the 1922, they discovered King Tut's tomb. So Egyptian-type themes were somewhat influenced in his design of that theater. Mm. But it's just beautiful. It's just a shame it's still not there.
The theaters that were being built at that era, and you mentioned the Nickelodeon, strictly dedicated to motion pictures. That might strike some people as strange, but originally theaters were, I mean, there was for live shows too, right?
Were vaudeville.
Movies. Yeah, vaudeville.
And my talk actually starts, I kind of take you through the, and it's called The History of Butler Movie Theaters, but I also start with opera houses. Now, opera houses were not places where they were playing Carmen. These were places of live entertainment, not highbrow entertainment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I start with those, and starting what most of them were a combination of showing movies and live vaudeville performances. So even the Pen, which is our last theater built in Butler, which opened in 1938, it still had a stage. though it was built mainly for theaters, they still had live entertainment there. And kind of a neat thing that people can see if they're my age, a little younger, a little older, was they probably remember the Paul Shannon Adventure Time on Channel 4 in Pittsburgh. And we used to rush home from school when we were kids for 3:30 when Paul Shannon came on.
Three Stooges were on there.
And Paul Shannon is what repopularized the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
They had both basically been forgotten because they had made the shorts back in the 30s and 40s, couple movies in the 50s, and they were pretty much forgotten until Paul Shannon started to show their shorts. So one really neat thing that I found that you'll see if you come to the talk, that I found a movie clip, not just a picture, but I found a movie clip of the kids waiting outside the Penn Theater in probably 1962, waiting for Paul Shannon to do a personal appearance in the Penn Theater.
Wow, I didn't even know that he did that.
And so he came and did the personal appearance, and so I have a movie clip of the kids waiting outside. So some people may see themselves or their brothers or sisters or cousins waiting to go in and see Paul Shannon. And then I have a clip of Paul Shannon standing on the stage of the Penn Theater with his magic sword that he used to use to raise his imaginary curtain on his TV show. So that was really neat when I found that, because I always watched Paul Shannon.
Now, these video clips, these pictures that you have, these high-def pictures, do you project them when people come to see the
talk? Right. The pictures are all projected on a very large screen at the park.
So
it's been a marvelous trip through memory lane and historical-wise. I talk about a lot of the famous performers who came here to Butler, including a United States president who spoke on the stage of one of our theaters, and some really kind of neat stories with about him and his arrival into Butler, and many other famous performers that came here, and stories that go with it. So it's not all just about architecture. A lot of it's about stories and events, including several movie stars from Butler who went to Hollywood after growing up here.
Butler had movie stars, native Butlerites?
Native Butlerites.
Wow.
And so I have photos of them. The one, a picture of her beautiful house that still stands. And I show a movie clip from her most famous film in the talk. So it's really a human interest. You get to see wonderful pictures of the architecture of the theaters. And for younger people, they will be amazed that movie theaters once looked the way movie theaters used to look. Now we go to the multiplex.
It's a square box.
It's a square box with a white screen.
Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah.
And the movie theaters built in the United States up through even the Penn in 38, which wasn't real, it wasn't ornamental. But even it was an Art Deco theater. And I have another one of those eureka moments. When I located the pictures of the Penn Theater on opening night, just before it opened, showing the theater as it first looked, which was much different from I remembered it looking, where the side walls were just curtains. But it had some, you know, real pretty architectural features to it. And I also found with the Penn, its original layout, a drawing in a 1938 movie magazine, and the list of where they got everything they used to build the theater. Now, the neat thing with that is I found the company that built the marquee. And, of course, we have a group of dedicated individuals who are working and desire to restore the theater as a live entertainment venue. And so I contacted this company, and it still exists. So if the project goes through, we very well may be able to have the Penn Marquee restored to its original appearance when it opened in 1938.
What about the exterior of these buildings? And I think you and I share the same philosophy on this. I just detest when the original facades of buildings are covered up with aluminum panels. which has done so much. Well, let's put it this way. It used to be done a whole lot back in the 50s and 60s. Many of the downtown buildings. The classic example I use is Woolworth's, because everyone knows whenever they started to come loose and blow down all over the place. And people said, well, look, that was a pretty nice-looking building before they covered it up with all those lousy aluminum panels.
Many of our buildings were.
Yes.
I think where the Brick House is located, Larry Gettler, who has the two restaurants there and who's done a great job on the interior, but Eaton Park came in, and that was two movie theaters. And it's somewhat of a complicated story, but we'll just say for right now, the one people would remember on the right-hand side was the Capitol. And it still had the facade on it until Eaton Park came and they ripped off the beautiful artwork that was on that building. Now, I will say this Saturday, and I want to give him some major credit because I really appreciate it. Larry Gettler, who owns the Brick House, has a real appreciation for what was there. And so he took me on a tour above his restaurant, what is left of the Lyric Capitol Theater. And the proscenium is still there, and one of the a beautiful, ornate theater mask of a, I guess, comedy tragedy is on the side of the proscenium. Mm-hmm. The balcony is there. So it was – I really appreciate that Larry took his time because he's a very busy guy – and took me on a tour of that.
See, I didn't know. Folks, we're talking to Bill May, a local historian and storyteller, and I use those terms, I use both of those terms because there are lots of very competent historians who can't tell a story worth a lick. They're boring, quite frankly. Bill is anything but, as I'm sure you know, if you've been to any of his programs. So he's a historian and storyteller. He's got a new program. It's going to debut this Thursday night, Thursday evening, at the Carousel Shelter at Alameda Park. It's free on the Butler's old movie theaters. Now, I knew that there was a theater. Here are the theaters that I remember from Butler. This is just me. The Penn, the Butler, which was the one that was you talked about. It became a parking lot with a PNC Bank.
Yeah,
drive-in bank there. It's not there anymore. It's just a parking lot now. Next to what used to be Kirkpatrick Sporting Goods, right?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay, so that's two. Then there was the Capitol. I didn't realize there were two theaters. I thought it was just one.
And I think it would be a really – it's a really cool experience when you go in there. So if you're looking for a great dinner some night, go to the Brick House and you can sit outside of it. And if you sit inside, you're sitting inside the State Theater. Mm. And on the right side, that was Eaton Park, you're sitting inside the Lyric, which later was named the Capitol. So it's a neat experience if you go in there and have dinner. It's great food and great ambiance to know those were movie theaters.
And those were almost directly across the street from the Penn. So it must have been like whenever there used to be four gas stations at an intersection. You know, the competition was right across the street.
Now, downtown Butler used to be a busy place. As I transitioned through on the talk, I even show video clips of downtown Butler in the early 1940s when it's filled with people walking. And maybe people will see their grandparents walking up and down Main Street to show why there were all these theaters in downtown Butler. Downtown Butler was a real hub of entertainment and dining and shopping. And part of that experience were the theaters, which is one reason I think it would be wonderful if they could reopen the Penn for entertainment to make downtown more of a hub for that type of activity.
Be great. Yeah. Even the preliminary work they've done at restoring some of the neon lights in the marquee, whenever you see it lit up at night, just changes the whole atmosphere
does,
of that particular
does,
block.
It really does.
Now, the only other one that I know of that we haven't mentioned, we mentioned it briefly, is the Majestic. which was by far the biggest, wasn't it? At least it looks from the outside. It's a monstrous. It's right across from the, right across the street from Geibel Funeral.
It had about the same seating, a little less seating capacity than the Butler did.
Really? Wow.
It seated 1,500, and the Butler Theater seated just a little shy of 2,000. And the Majestic had two balconies in it.
Oh, and that's why it's so tall then, the building's so tall.
You know, we always like to think that kids in previous generations were so well behaved. But I can tell you my own grandfather sat in the balcony of the Majestic Theater and used to throw things at people as they came in underneath him. And also, though, I probably don't know if I'll tell this story at the talk in case there's children there, but we're also a lot of traveling salesmen would come to Butler in those days. And, of course, one piece of entertainment was to go to a show. Mm-hmm. And the Majestic showed movies as well as had vaudeville acts, which were kind of like the America's Got Talent of that early part of the 20th century. And there were a couple of traveling salesmen who were arrested along with two ladies of the night who were plying the oldest profession in the balcony of the Majestic Theater.
That building still exists, partly physicians' offices now, isn't it?
It is, and I believe I was able to get in there about 20 years ago. And most of the interior of that is torn out. Uh-huh. But again, I do have interior photos of when it opened in 1904. And one thing people don't, if you look at that building at the top floor, there was a dance hall up there. So I was able to get up there, and I have pictures of that dance hall where my own grandfather used to go to dances. And there is a little person, his name was Colonel Ike Scanlon, and he would sell the Butler Times newspaper on the corner of Jefferson and Main. He was also a train caller down at the B&O station, but he had his own orchestra called the Star Orchestra, and he would play in the dance hall as well as other places in town. I have a photo of him in top hat and tails, and he conducted an orchestra, and there was a little stage on top of the Majestic in the very top floor. And so we'll talk a little bit about that in my talk.
No wonder I thought it was the biggest movie theater, because the building was gargantuan. It had two balconies and a dance hall above that.
And it had nine dressing rooms in the basement. And
oh, my.
The night it opened, they auctioned off the tickets because it was Butler's first real, large, sophisticated theater.
So is that the oldest of all the ones you're going to be talking about?
The oldest that was actually reopened as a theater was the Majestic. But there were two older opera houses that I'll talk about. Again, a lot of famous people were there.
Mm-hmm.
And some cool stories about the big fires that took those theaters down.
Wow. Wow, I'm psyched up. Well, I love local history. I do. It's fascinating. And it doesn't matter how old you are. Everybody has some people's memories might only go back 20 or 30 years. Some might go back 70 or 80, you know.
And at those theaters, I think I even have the story of the last performance. It was called the Park Theater that sat on the diamond where Morgan Center sits now. And it burned in a spectacular fire that I'll tell the really cool story about that fire in the talk. And it burned in 1903, which is why the Majestic gets built in 1904.
Ah.
But I have the story of the last performance at that Park Theater, who was a very famous Confederate general.
Mm.
And I will tell one of the stories he told on that very stage on the last night of its existence. And I even have the last words ever spoken on that stage.
Are you, you mentioned the dedicated group that's trying to raise funds and hopefully restore the pen. This has been done in a few other places around here. The Strand in Zelianopol comes to mind. There's also a theater in Greensburg. When I was in high school, I went to high school in that area, and that was a movie theater.
The Palace.
It's now the Palace, yeah. It's a concert venue. I mean, and they get, you know, Paul Anka was just there, Gordon Lightfoot, Olivia Newton-John was scheduled to appear this week until she's taken ill. So they got big names there. But that was a movie theater whenever I was. It was called the Manus. Manos, M-A-N-O-S, I believe, movie theater. So that was converted. But more importantly, for historians, it was saved. The building was saved.
It was saved. Yeah. And many towns across the country have done this. People sell Butler short too often. And if other communities, when I travel, because I have an interest in theaters, I'll go into these towns, and you see one town after another who either still has their theater open for some movies, mainly it's live entertainment. One town after another are either currently have them open or restoring them. Not, I mean, it's wonderful to save the architecture and the beauty, but it's an economic catalyst for those communities. And opening up the pen and bringing people back downtown, they then eat in our restaurants, they do some shopping. It's an economic catalyst. And the representatives of that PEN group will be at my talk, that people can talk to them before or after my program and talk to them what they're doing and how you can get involved or donate.
Well, I like what you said about many people tend to sell Butler short. Look at Greensburg. Who would believe that Paul Anka, Olivia Newton-John, Gordon Lightfoot would come to Greensburg, for goodness sakes, to an old movie theater? Well, those people would go to Pittsburgh. No, they go to Greensburg. Think of the money that brings into that town.
My wife and I go to see many shows at the Strand in Zeeland Opal.
Debbie Reynolds was there a couple of years ago. She just died, of course.
And when we go to the Strand, we eat at this nice little restaurant there called the Shoe Brew. Mm-hmm. So we spend our money in Zeeland Opal. So I just don't like when people sell Butler short. And I think the Penn Theater Project could be a real positive for not just Main Street, but for the whole community. People need to remember, when people think of Butler, it's not just the city. If you live in the township or center township, it's still your town. And making it vibrant on Main Street helps all of us.
Can you remember the least amount you ever paid for a movie theater ticket?
I believe I went to a Saturday double feature matinee at the Penn. And the one movie starred Sharon Tate, because she had just recently been murdered by the Manson brothers.
Great. She's in a movie.
And then the other one was The House on Haunted Hill with
Vincent Price.
And I'm sure if people coming to the talk, it'll bring back a lot of memories to them. I know I saw Flipper at the Butler Theater.
I can't remember the actual shows, and it could have been, you know, like B-movies, you know, but I can remember the town where I spent my childhood years, my elementary years, was Parker up along the river, and that town had a theater, believe it or not, down on the River Avenue, right next to the Allegheny River. If you were a kid under 12 and you went to a Saturday matinee, it was a quarter.
Wow.
To get in. Now, again, they may have been B-run movies. I have no idea what they were, but I can remember going there for a quarter on a Saturday matinee, and I was probably, it's probably 50 cents if you went to an evening performance. You know?
They weren't quite as expensive as they are today in Butler. Your radio station ran a big amateur contest back in the 1940s at the Penn Theater, a big build-up of it. Mm. There were lots of contests at all the theaters. A friend of mine that I know who's a wonderful guy, his name's Buck Taylor, and he told me he went to a contest or a movie or a live performance at the Capitol. Capitol was known for showing the Western, particularly B-Westerns. And he won a Lone Ranger outfit when he was a kid.
So WISR had like what? Like America's Got Talent or something?
America's Got Talent.
Wow.
America's Got Talent at the theaters.
At the Penn. Well, listen, folks, if this is intriguing, how could it not be, for goodness sakes? And again, I don't care how old you are. This is interesting stuff. Bill May, his program on Butler's old movie theaters, but it actually covers periods before they were just showing movies, too, when they were live entertainment houses. Coming up this Thursday at the Carousel Shelter at Alameda Park. That's under shelter.
Under shelter if
so
it rains.
If it's raining, big deal. That's a big, I was at a wedding reception there once. Poured. Nobody got wet. It was fine. You know, until we had to leave. You know,
yeah, then it wasn't so good, I guess.
But again, it's free. This is a multimedia presentation.
Multimedia. I have dozens of photos. I have video clips like the one I mentioned of Paul Shannon's visit to Butler when he appeared at the Penn. Then I have movie clips of some movies that showed at the theaters, particularly the ones of our Butler movie stars.
Mm-hmm. You know, now that you mention it, I never saw Paul Shannon. I remember Paul Shannon, Three Stooges. But those Pittsburgh entertainers in the early days of TV, they did go around making personal appearances.
Yes,
I can remember my parents took my brother and I, we were little kids, to see Hank Stoll, who was a puppeteer, and for one of the afternoon shows. I think all the Pittsburgh stations had him for kids. Hank Stoll at the Silver Fox Playhouse in St. Petersburg. Did you ever hear of that?
Yes.
You ever heard about that place? Still there. I think it's a barn. It was an old barn. But I'd forgotten about that. And when you mentioned Paul Shannon, brought back memories. Thanks, Bill. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Again, Bill's program is this Thursday, 6:30, I think you said, right?
6:30 at the Carousel Shelter of Alameda Park. It's undercover, and it's free, and it's about an hour in length. Lots of stories, pictures that most people have never seen, video clips. I think they'll really enjoy it.
So what are you working on now? I'm sure you have another project going already.
I have another I'll also be doing the Biddle Boys again in August, mm-hmm. if people have not seen it or want to see it again.
Weren't you in the process of writing a book on the Biddle Boys? Do I remember
that? I am. I'm still researching. I keep hoping to retire, and that's my retirement project. One I have almost completed, and I'm probably going to do it twofold, as a walking tour, and then I will probably do it next year at Alameda as a slideshow, like the movie talk I'm doing this Thursday on the walking tour or history of the grand houses of Butler.
Oh, I hesitate to ask you because I think, you know, if you're working on a project, maybe you want to keep that secret for a while. So I apologize for that.
Oh, that's fine. Publicity is always good for people to look forward to. The walking tour, I don't have a date on either yet, but it will be focusing, the walking tour will focus of going up North McCain Street, East Fulton, and East Pearl Street. And I have original photos of the homes and stories of who built them. And Elm Court, the Phillips Mansion, mm-hmm. is included on it. So I hope people will also enjoy that talk. People always say nothing ever happened here, but it's the opposite. Butler is filled with history.
Absolutely. You just got to look for it.
Yeah. Just have to look for it.
More to come. We'll take a break. Hey, we're going to say hi to one of our summer interns this year. She's just joined us here at Butler Radio Group. Her name is Julie Zarnick. We always like to chat with our interns. Also, still to come later on the program, one of America's most popular writers of inspirational fiction. Her name is Karen Kingsbury, and she's going to join us for a little bit later on the program. Coming up later this week, Vietnam. Talking with Mark Bowden. He's the guy who wrote Black Hawk Down. If you haven't read the book, maybe you've seen the film. He has written an incredible new book on the turning point of the Vietnam War, Way, 1968. We'll be chatting with him later this week on the program as well. Okay, quick break. Back with more on It's Your Turn on WISR after this.
There are times in our lives when we just don't want to be alone. We just need somebody, somebody who listens, somebody who understands. This is particularly true when we lose a loved one, a person who means so much to us. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers a unique, sensitive program called Someone's Caring, meticulously designed to help ease your emotional pain. Men and women are invited to attend, and yes, men are realizing it's okay to express their feelings in a small group. We have hundreds of sessions over the last 20 years. Years have helped many hundreds of people cope with their feelings. We have five programs: a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of suicide, for bereaved parents, for those who have lost a beloved pet, and individual sessions. They're conducted by our own trained bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller. Call us at Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler, 287-3706, 724-287-3706. We can help. Thompson Miller Funeral Home, the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Always informative and fun to talk with Bill May. Hey, we're going to say hello to one of our summer interns here at Butler Radio Group and WISR. Her name is Julie Zarnick, and she just joined us, last week, I think you were first here, right?
Yeah, last week. This is my fourth day here.
Yes. So. Well, nice to say hello. We always like to chat a little bit with our summer interns whenever they join us. Are you from the Butler area, Julie?
Oh, yes, I am. I graduated Butler High School, and I also went to Butler County Community College, BC3. So,
where are you going to school now?
I'm going to Edinburgh University now, and this year it'll be my senior year. So,
you have one more year?
One more year.
Of undergraduate school anyway.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
Any plans after that? Do you hope to join the workforce somewhere or more schooling or?
Probably, I don't think I want to go back to school, honestly, but I plan on working afterwards wherever I can get a job in broadcasting, radio, anything. That's why I'm working here, to get the experience.
Now, every school is different in terms of when I was in undergraduate school, my major was broadcast journalism, but I was in the School of Communications. Mm-hmm. What's the setup at Edinburgh?
At Edinburgh right now, I think they put them together. So communications, journalism, and public relations is all one group in one building. So right now, my major is journalism with public relations. So I guess you could say it's like communications too, but. Yeah.
I like to keep track of that because, unfortunately, journalists are becoming fewer and fewer these days, as are journalism jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I rue that because, I am one. Number
yeah.
one. I think it's important for us, but I'm just wondering if colleges are going to start gearing their programs more perhaps toward digital media, in the near future, because that seems to be a growing field.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But digital media, I don't even know. I don't even know exactly what route I personally want to take in this journalism major.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, that's why I'm here. I'm learning all these different areas of journalism and broadcasting.
Well, I think that's the great thing about internship. In fact, I would cast a wary eye on someone who said, I know just exactly what I want to do, because that's silly at your age. But to be able to try out a couple of things, try this and say, this is fun, try this. Oh, I couldn't stand to be able to do what's the worst thing in the world? Go to a job every day that's drudgery. My gosh.
I could not do that. No, I have to love what I'm doing, and
absolutely.
I already know that. So.
Yeah, you need a passion for that and be able to get a feel for it, through internships. There was a time when about the only undergraduate majors who got to do this were students who were planning to be teachers, because everyone had a student teaching requirement that they had to go somewhere for a semester and actually teach, which would be a pretty good indicator of whether or not you were going to like that as a career.
Yeah, exactly.
But not too many other majors had a chance.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I was in school, there weren't too many internships around. Now, that's pretty much expected, isn't it? At least you could try to get one.
So. Honestly, they in Edinburgh, at least, they try to push you to get an internship, because in this field, it's more hands-on. You learn doing hands-on things rather than, out of a textbook. Mm-hmm. You have to learn how to do things hands-on and be there face-to-face to learn what you're doing in the field, So definitely they push you for internships. And they're counted as credited classes, too, so that's always good. So
we're especially pleased to have Julie with us for a few months this summer because she was a successful scholarship winner through WISR, through, I don't know, was that CSAC or BMI or somebody
CSAC.
Like that?
CSAC, yeah.
It's one of the licensing companies. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that. Every time we play a song on WISR, we have to pay a fee to the composer, and that's all taken care of through companies, ASCAP, American Society of Composers and Publishers, and other people. So, but these companies do offer scholarships, and voila, Julie was able to win one. So
yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Dave. And it was an honor for me to win. Honestly, I filled out my application and I turned in my essay, and I think it was like mid-March when I did that. And by the time they called me, I forgot about it. I was worrying about finals. I was worrying about school, and I forgot that I even turned it in. And I never even thought that I would have a shot at winning it because of all the people. I remember I was talking to T. David Luther, and he's the one that called me, and he said it was like out of 450 people or whatever. So I felt very honored to win that, and I'm using it definitely.
You must have written a pretty good essay.
I guess, yeah, and it was only 250 words. You guys, 250 words is a lot harder to get than, say 500.
She wants to be a journalist. I'd say she's a pretty good writer already. Yeah.
Must be. I don't know, but I was very happy. And I love radio. Radio is probably where I'm taking this. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Edinburgh, I did an hour radio show there, and I would do color commentary for sports there, and I just loved it. I have a passion for radio, so this is where I'm taking it now.
The most intimate of all mass media, but that's another essay, and I won't bore you with that, but I have a whole program I could do on that. So how long are you going to be with us, do you know?
I think I'll be here until mid-July, maybe.
Oh, good.
Maybe the end of July, so yeah.
I know I'm taking you away from one of your projects, so I'll let you get back to it. But we wanted to say hi and welcome. Nice to have you on board
for
a while.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
WISR. Julie Zeinik from Butler with us here today. Okay, we need to take a break. Our final guest will be joining us. We'll be chatting with her by telephone. She's Karen Kingsbury, and she's one of the more popular New York Times best-selling novelists. America's favorite inspirational storyteller. We'll talk to her coming up. Yeah, and it's your turn on WISI in just a couple of minutes. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Dave Malarkey. Ever have a tough time getting the motor started early in the morning? I know what you mean. Well, maybe I can help. I'd like to invite you to join me every weekday morning, Monday through Friday, for the Early Morning Show here on WISR. We start with the first local news of the day, bright and early at 5:30. We go to 9:30, and oh, yes, we pause for half an hour and have coffee with Kate at 8:30 every weekday morning, too. Please join me. I'd like to share the early morning hours, 5:30 weekdays, here on WISR.
Hi. I found a toy dinosaur over on the playground by Smith Street. It had this phone number on it, and... well, I just wanted to make sure the dinosaur made it back to its little owner.
Yeah, hi. I think I found your kid's stuffed animal near the swing set. Just want to call. I'm sure she misses it.
I know my son gets super attached to the smallest things, even a fire truck. And I'd be happy to drop it off. The toy was a little muddy, so I cleaned it up, and it's good to go whenever you're around.
When I found the little sippy cup, I just had to give you a call. It's for a kid, you know?
We'd do anything for kids. Yet 1 in 5 children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. Help end childhood hunger and give all of our kids the meals they need to grow. Learn how at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
What a treat we have, listeners, to be able to chat for the next few minutes with Karen Kingsbury. Extremely well-known author, and she's got a new book out, surprise. It's called Love Story, and it's the continuing tale of the Baxter family, which I know many of you have come to know and love. First of all, Karen Kingsbury, wow. Hi. It's really nice to have you with us here for a few minutes today.
Thank you, Dave. It's such an honor to be here. I'm excited about it.
Karen Kingsbury is the number one New York Times best-selling novelist. She is... an inspirational storyteller. I'm sure she won't mind being described as that. As a matter of fact, Time Magazine recognized you, Karen, as the queen of inspirational fiction. Hey, pretty nice, huh?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be the queen of something, I'm pretty thankful for that. It's great.
How many novels have you written now about the Baxter family?
Well, it has been 23 novels, and I look back and I think, how in the world did that even happen? Because all I see over the last 2 decades is just raising my family and having these beautiful moments, but most of the gist of them, at least, wound up with these Baxter characters. And, now Roma Downey and Mark Burnett and MGM Studios are doing a TV series on the Baxter family, which will debut in spring of 2018. So people kept saying, well, but where did they begin? And so Love Story is the prequel. It's the beginning. It's the very first time we get to meet John and Elizabeth falling in love back when they were just college kids.
And you have, and I know that, I don't suppose that you have any direct input on the cover or photograph, but I've got a review copy of your book sitting right here in front of me, and it's glorious. The title is Love Story, and you have John and Elizabeth kind of in a romantic hug next to a bicycle. It's a wonderful picture.
Well, thank you. You know, I didn't have anything to do with that. I can give all credit to Simon & Schuster, my publisher, but when I saw this, I still can't stop looking at it. I just want to be there, and I want to know why there's deep emotion there between them, and it's perfect. It just captures the story, which really, it's a broken, beautiful story, and how many of us can't say we can relate somehow to having a broken, beautiful story?
We will cover some ground that is no doubt familiar to longtime readers about the Baxters, but give us a little bit of the time frame for Love Story, Karen Kingsbury. We're talking what decade here when John and Elizabeth Baxter first lived out their love story?
Well, they are college students, and it's in the 1970s, which, you know, doesn't really seem like throwback vintage era, but it is, you know, for us now. It's been a while ago. And John's in med school. He's not a believer in God, and he's sort of angry about his past, but he's very determined to be successful in his future. And he falls madly, deeply, passionately in love with Elizabeth. And she's a freshman. She's younger and very sheltered. And the two of them just have this this chemistry and this love affair that is beautiful until they find out that Elizabeth is pregnant. And so, you know, this is a sets up this sort of thing that becomes a secret for the Baxters that even readers don't find out about till many books in, that John and Elizabeth had a son that they were forced to give up for adoption, and how they survived that and how they managed to cling to each other and find hope and a second chance and a love that is still playing out among their children and grandchildren.
Yes, adult children and grandchildren now. By the way, the school that they attended when they fell in love, is that fictional or is that a real place?
University of Michigan, yes, that's a real place. And, you know, there's always going to be a little bit of my own fingerprints in these books. So when I was age 7 to age 10, we lived about 7 houses away from Michigan Stadium. And, I mean, I think you, by obligation, blue and gold kind of run through your veins then forever that you're going to be a U of M fan. So that plays out here.
You know what I thought of immediately when you said that, blue and gold running through your veins? I'm a baby boomer, so you can place me chronologically. The movie The Big Chill, which is one of my favorite films of all time, about the people that are now adults, but they've been together as undergraduates at Michigan, and they were gathering for the funeral of one of their classmates. You know the film I'm talking about, of course.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, classic. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, we live so close, we could hear the announcers, and we parked cars in our yard. You know, we had the chalkboard, park here, and hot coffee and cocoa for people if they came and parked at our yard. And it was just, you know, it was such an adventure and such a special time. My dad would take us all down, us 5 kids, and we were just young, and my dad would march us down at halftime, and the guy at the gate would just kind of wink at him and let us in. If there was a spot, you know, in that huge stadium, then we would find it and we could stay, and we'd stay long after the game and listen to the marching band, and it was just a memorable time. So when I can give a nod to a school I love, I give a lot of nods to Liberty University. I love that university now, but Michigan's just part of that childhood for sure.
Yeah, I was looking over your bio, which came from your publicist, and it noted that you are, I don't know, are you still an adjunct professor of writing at Liberty?
I am. So 4 of our younger boys, our 4 youngest, are all there. I probably have a record or something for having most students at Liberty. And my way of getting to go and visit with them and spend time on that beautiful campus is I get to go and teach. So I come twice a semester to campus, and I teach some master classes and do some online, filming some online classes for their online program as well. And it has just been a delight. I'm I'm always just honored just to step on campus and be a part of it.
We are certainly not going to reveal the denouement of Karen Kingsbury's latest love story, but outline the plot just a little bit for us, Karen. Obviously, it's a prequel, so you go back to when John and Elizabeth Baxter had first met while they were in college and fallen in love and so on. How do we get back there from the present day?
So it's a grandson, Cole, and he's in high school, and he's got a project he's supposed to write about a part of his heritage and his background. And so he goes to his grandfather, and he says, "Papa, could you please tell me about the love story between you and Grandma Elizabeth?" Now, the challenge is that Elizabeth has passed away many years ago now, and John is remarried. And so it's going to be an adventure and challenge to his heart. In fact, he gets tears in his eyes just when Cole asks him about this love story, because he has been able to learn how to live without her, but she was the love of his life, and so he has to have a kind of communication and conversation with his current wife to say, what do you think? Should I do this? And mm-hmm. she gives him her blessing. Go ahead, go back. You know, relive it. It's okay. I can take it. And she gives him a space. And so they go back, and John, through a series of 4 weeks, tells the story. And I wanted the readers to really be there. So those many chapters are really written as if it's actually playing out right now. And it just takes us to that first dance when their eyes first connected. And through all the kind of tragedy and trial and eventually some triumph that happens from that point on.
Yeah, that would be certainly tough for John. It would be tough for his second wife, too.
Very tough. Yeah. Yeah, very tough.
There's also a secondary story. All good novels have a secondary story. That has to do with Baxter family friend Cody Coleman.
Yes. Now, Cody has had a hard time. So initially, Cody was so in love with Bailey Flanagan. And the Flanagans are family friends with the Baxters, so we've kind of followed both these families. And now Bailey is married to someone else and very happily married, and Cody had fallen in love with Bailey's friend Andy. So it's just these two have had this sort of tumultuous sort of relationship where they've been through two broken engagements. And now they're very much separated as we start this story, but we get a chance to kind of ride out with Cody the way that the heart works and how you can't always forget someone that you're meant to be with. And along the way, there's some minor love stories that play out as well that kind of show us just that power. I mean, I think this will remind people, love story will remind everyone, I don't care if you're married or single, about the love story that's happening in your life, even the one where God is pursuing you out of love. And creating a love story that all of us we're all writing some form of a love story with our days.
I like your title, but it does raise a question. It was a pretty famous book and movie by that same title. Do you run into any, I have no idea about this question. Do you have any legal hoops that you have to jump through there, or is there some kind of a statute of limitations, or what's the deal on that, Karen?
That's a great question. I love that book, and where we got a chance to see Ryan O'Neal and Ally McGraw play the characters in that book, Love Story by Eric Siegel. Mm-hmm. You can't copyright a title, and that's true with songs or with books. So any number of books can be written with the title Love Story. But I think you have to be wise, because, like, for me, I know an author only has one chance, if that, to write a book called Love Story. So I can tell you, this is my favorite book. Like, I would read this 100 times over, and when I finished it, I told my husband, like, I could live in this story. I love this story. So I always knew in the back of my mind I'd love to have a book titled Love Story, partly as a nod to the original classic, and partly because I knew I needed to write John and Elizabeth's story, and I couldn't think of any other word for it, any other title. So, you're absolutely right. There's a connection.
Our time begins to run short, and I know your schedule is tight. How did you ever get started writing about the Baxters? Where did you come up with the idea? Is there anything even remotely semi-autobiographical here?
Oh, definitely. You know, I was on a flight coming home from a speaking event, and I feel like God just gave me the whole family. Over a three-hour flight, I had their names, I had the first five books all figured out and kind of outlined, and I mean, I just had tears in my eyes and kept wiping tears off my cheeks thinking, oh my goodness, this is a great idea, this story of this family and their adult children through their trials and triumphs and how they're making life come together and making it work and going through loss together even. And so by the time I landed, I called my dad and I told him, he was always, my dad was just the one who was my greatest cheerleader. And he said, Karen, this sounds like a hope opera. He said, it sounds like the kind of thing where you could go any number of directions and deal with any kind of topic, and the family would be this sort of rock with their faith and with each other, where you could keep coming back to them. My dad's been gone home to heaven now for about a decade, but I just believe on a day like today when Love Story comes out that he has a window, and he's smiling because he believed in seeing, you know, the books happen the way they're happening right now.
One final question. Is the TV adaptation by Roma Downey, will she be in it? And have you met her?
We have become such good friends. Yes, I go out to Los Angeles. She lives in Malibu on the beach. And I go out and have lunch with her and just sit there and dream about where the series is going several times a year. We've been doing that now for about 2 years. And the series will debut on TV this spring, so spring of 2018. And I'll just keep everyone up to date on even how you can audition for parts in the show at KarenKingsbury.com. So you can read a little bit more about our family and about the book and Love Story, where you can get it, and about the TV series as well.
It's the latest, listeners, from Karen Kingsbury. The Baxter family continues with a wonderful prequel. The title is Love Story. Thanks, Karen. Nice to meet you. Delightful to chat with you today.
Thank you, Dave. We'll look forward to doing it again.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 5252. The pick 3, 075075. The pick 4, 6821, 6821. The pick 5, 02162. And the wild ball for each of those is 8. And your treasure hunt, 6, 12, 14, 15, and 16. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Very delightful to chat with Karen Kingsbury, who shouldn't look old enough to have written that many Baxter family novels. Many of them under development as TV movies and major motion pictures, and her many Baxter books, the subject of a new TV series. The Baxter family, which is scheduled to debut sometime, I guess, later this year, with Roma Downey and some others from MGM Studios. Nice lady. Certainly enjoyed our chat earlier today with William F. Buckley Jr. biographer, Alvin Felsenberg. I can remember almost accidentally coming across William F. Buckley on Channel 13 when I was coming of age, teenager, and would watch The Firing Line. Always fun. Didn't always agree with him, which probably you shouldn't, I don't think, with syndicated writers, but he was fun to watch. He was. And we thank Mr. Felsenberg for the title of his book. If you're looking to learn more about the late William F. Buckley Jr., the book is A Man and His Presidents. And, of course, Julie Zarnick, our intern, stopping in to say hi today. And it's always great fun to chat with Bill May, local historian and storyteller. Man knows more stories about local history than you can imagine. By the way, his program, we had a listener who wanted to make sure she had the right day. It's Thursday of this week. That's when they begin the Outdoor Discovery Series at Alameda Park, and I think it's every Thursday through the summer, but at any rate, it's this Thursday for Bill May at the Carousel Shelter, 6:30. I guess there are some signs that may have a different date. I'm not sure, but it's Thursday. We have a great lineup of guests coming later this week. I don't have time to tell you all about them, but we will be chatting with James Martin, who is a Jesuit priest. He's been on, he's been all the major television networks and TV shows. He is the editor-at-large of America Magazine. And he's a fascinating person, pretty deep thinker. He'll be with us later in the week for a chat. Also, Mark Bowden. He's the man who wrote Black Hawk Down. You may have seen the film, pretty good movie, a few years back. He writes about one of the crucial battles in the American War in Vietnam. You know, we're far enough past Vietnam now that we're able to look back on it pretty dispassionately. It was the Battle of Hue. Hue, 1968, turning point in the American War in Vietnam. So that's coming up later this week as well. And lots of other guests, too, on the It's Your Turn program. It's only Monday, and we'll have a lot of fun as we get together this week. Hope you can join.